This is a very lovely occasion. We were blessed with some sprinkles of rain to begin with, and also the teaching on uncertainty, sprinkled with that as well, just to keep us on our dhammic toes. Who knew whether it was going to rain even more and pour throughout the whole event, or stop just as it did to give us a very ideal weather for this occasion. Not too hot, not too cold. It's also just considering that this ceremony, and my Lumpur Pasanno, myself, and Venerable Tanavara were the only bhikkhus here that weren't ordained in this forest. So this is very much a homegrown sangha, and it's very delightful also having Ajahn Kurundamo, Ajahn Nyaniko being the chanting acharyas, because they also were hatched right here in the middle of this forest, and being present for both of their training from the beginning. It was quite wonderful to be able to be here and to be present for that, in the sense of generations being... There's a unique flavor as you sort of taste the flow of Dhamma, the flow of life through generations, and seeing that, as Lumpur was mentioning, those who came here 20 years ago were all a lot grayer and more wrinkled than the day we rolled up Tomkai Road for the first time. A few of us who are here today were in that first wagon train up from San Francisco. Yeah. And it's very lovely and heartening as a special kind of flavor to that, to seeing the generations passing the torch of Dhamma from one to another. And also many times during the ceremony, Lumpur referred to how things that were established by the Buddha 2,500 years ago, 25 centuries ago, that's a lot of generations. So if you have a generation about 25 years or 30 years, that's... you've got 70 or 100 generations since the time of the Buddha, and the torch has been passed from one generation to another through this extraordinary expanse of time. And it's quite miraculous and wonderful that this training and this system of teachings and practices is still alive here in the U.S. in this present time. As he was quoting Robert Thurman at this talk. Robert Thurman is a kind of barnstorming speaker, and he's saying, people talk about Dharma in the West, I think it'd be a great idea. It hasn't happened yet, and I think I'm really looking forward to it. He's extremely forthright. That's his whole manner, but it was his idea that it's not really until there's a free lunch monastery that is established in the West that you can really say that the Dharma has arrived here. So it has been pointed out to him that there are a few free lunch monasteries around, but it's a very very encouraging to see how that the roots are really, I feel, going down firmly and deeply into the earth. We know there's a dry season through half the year, and these trees of the forest and the grasses, they put their roots down really, really, really deep into the earth so they can stay alive through the dry season. And I feel that the Dhamma has indeed put its roots very firmly and deeply into the land here. Also, for the candidates, Venerable Kantiko, Venerable Gambiro taking on the bhikkhu life, and Venerable Katapunyo and Venerable Jagaro taking on the Samanera life, there's a mixture, there's kind of two different things, well, many different things, but two particular things happening. There's a personal commitment that one is making to the training, that it's like a personal choice, personal decisions that are being made in this life, with this mind, this body, and this ancestry, these parents, this country that we're living in, the family that we're from. It's a personal decision. So on one side, the going forth and undertaking this training is a very individual. But the other part of it is that it's a commitment to a communal training, And at this same conference on mindfulness, one of the really interesting things, the presentation, I think Lumpur Pasanna was there for this on the last day. Clifford Sarin, who's a scientist who does most of his main scientific researcher for Alan Wallace's projects, he said some very interesting things and described some studies that he made. And one of the really interesting points is that you, according to the science, quote unquote, you can't meaningfully talk about practicing mindfulness on your own. It's a relational practice. You can't practice mindfulness without taking into account the context for your living, who you live with, who you work with, the family you come from, the world that you live on. You can't talk about me practicing mindfulness effectively. That it has to be an us, how I practice in relationship to the world. And it kind of, he's sort of preaching to the choir in some respects in terms of our life, but I felt it was really intriguing way to express it. Because that's essentially what Sangha life and the training in Sangha reflects. It's not just me on my own. We're surrounded by these other sort of bunch of people that kind of are, they're around, but you know they're not really involved in my practice. But it's really the opposite end of the scale. And not that I feel we need to have data to prove it when we can experience the results of it ourselves very directly. And certainly I've Lumpur and myself have been living this way of life for a few decades now and have seen the results over and over and over again. But to see how the power of a communal training and a communal practice when we live and work communally, then there's a strength in that and there's a liberating quality that comes from training in community and in communion that is just not there if the mind focuses on me and my practice or is creating a kind of dissociation or a dislocation from other people around us. So that was one of the things that really resonated for me, an interesting comment of his that there is this the sort of measurable effects of living and practicing with each other. But I also, as the candidates, the newly gone forth members of the Sangha here, Venerables Kantiko and Gambiro and Katapunyo and Chagaro, that as you take on these further commitments, that along with the extra rules that you've now got to remember and learn to recite and to embody, the commitment also is a commitment to these other folks that you live with, the assembly of monastics and the you know the lay community. It's a closer bond, a closer commitment to this group and that refuge of Sangha. Then the closer that quality of commitment is, the more that the refuge of Sangha becomes accessible, and the more that it say is caused to resonate and be a genuine source of inspiration and encouragement, a source of strength within your own lives. When we would I live at Amaravati Monastery in England, which is a very big place, and so this kind of numbers gathered here today would be like a small crowd for a Saturday at Amaravati, and about half the number that you get on an average Sunday, and so we take there's a communal taking of the precepts every weekend, every Saturday, every Sunday. It's a sort of a big communal voice is raised to take the refuges and precepts. And so it falls to me very often to be explaining and describing what these words mean. Again, as Lumpur was saying, it can easily become a kind of parroting of words. Well, everyone else is saying Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, so I suppose I should say those words too. I'm not quite sure what they mean, but everyone else is doing it, so I guess I ought to join in. But Lumpur Chao and Lumpur Samedo, our great teachers, have often emphasized that you know just saying the words is not taking refuge, it's just making noises. But it's the change of heart that comes through pronouncing those words, that's what really supports the quality of refuge, and that essentially, if we consider a refuge, it's a safe place for us. It's a place of shelter, like these wonderful. I've really been taking a few notes about these wonderful umbrellas, these shades. Not that we have to shelter from the sun so much in England, but I am really impressed with the design of these things. They're really a good example of human ingenuity. But a shelter is a safe place. So just the idea of the Buddha or the picture of the Sangha on the wall, or a collection of books that are words of Dhamma. You know, a collection of books is not a refuge. A Buddha Rupa is not a refuge. Your local Buddhist group is not a refuge. What the essential quality of refuge is, it's an attribute of your own being, your own heart. And so just as Lumpur was describing, that the word Buddha means awake. When we take refuge in Buddha, it means to choose to be awake. To take refuge in Dhamma is to choose to be in tune with reality, to be living in accord with nature, with the way things really are. And when I come to describe what's the inner quality or the inner attribute of taking refuge in Sangha, I've thought about it and used different ways of describing it as I've reflected over the years. And the way I like to talk about it now is to take refuge in Sangha is to listen to that in your heart which loves the good. There's in everybody, in all of us, there is something that loves the wholesome, the good, the noble. Even in the most deranged of people, sometimes you get people coming to the monastery who are literally belong to a gang of armed robbers. You know, Amaravati used to have a little collective of guys that their thing was armed robbery. They needed some guidance in meditation because they had some anxiety problems, but their thing was armed robbery. That's what they did. And so you couldn't say, get out of here, you evil people. Well, you could say that, but yeah, our style of practice when he and Lumpur Sumedho was consulted, he said, well, Lumpur, there are these guys, there's this kind of armed robbery gang from Liverpool, you know, should we just kick them out of the monastery or call the police? He said, no, they want to learn the Dhamma, they want to practice meditation, they should feed that in their heart, which is inclined towards goodness, because how else are they going to get any wholesome influences? So to take refuge in Sangha is to listen to that in the heart which loves the good and which aspires to the noble, and then that is fed through our companionship, through the Kalyanamitta, the spiritual friendship that comes from the good-hearted people with whom we live. And then in a retroactive way, the effort that we as individuals put into our practice as the newly hatched bhikkhus and samaniras, the effort that you put into your life and your practice will also inspire and encourage the people around you. It's not uncommon for someone who's been a monk or a nun for 4 or 5 years, 8 or 10 years, and they're kind of used to it, and they kind of know the routine, and they're kind of familiar with all of the chanting and the way you do things, and then they're not really conscious of having kind of slacked off a bit. But when the new candidates come in and they're all kind of super keen and they're always there on time for the morning meditation, they always sit straight as a poker and are always very helpful and kind and peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. And they go, oh, wow, God, Gambhiro, he's really impressive. Gee, you better kind of straighten up here, you know. These new guys are really impressive. I have to live up to the standard that these guys are embodying. And so our efforts encourage and uplift each other. The other aspect of this that I like to consider is that it's really important when you take on extra precepts and you're adopting a more refined and intricate form of discipline is to contemplate failure. It's really important to learn how to fail well. Now, I know I'm British by birth, but I lived in this country for quite a long time, 15 or 20 years altogether. And I am aware that the US is somewhat success obsessed. Like, winning is everything. The silver medal is not good enough. I never forget the image of this one skater, this one American girl who got the silver medal in the Olympic Games, and she's just weeping, heartbroken, distressed. She's only the second best skater in the world. And it was a heartbreak. It was a disaster. It's the end of everything because I'm only the second best in the world. Now, some of you might be thinking, right, well, of course you'd cry. That's kind of interesting. If that's the first thought your mind had, was that, well, of course, that's a it is a disaster to come second. But if you think there's 7 billion people who are not as good as you. Oh, right, right. There's only one that's better and 7 billion that are not quite as good. But there's something in our heart that says, oh, but I didn't win. So understanding the conditioning about winning, I feel it's really important to learn how to lose and to fail. Because if we take a precept and then we break it, we take a standard of speaking in ways that are honest and kind and noble, and then we're a little bit short with our fellow monks, or you're a little bit kind of aggressive towards a novice in the way you ask them to help out with shifting the woodpile, then that you can feel, oh, I'm so terrible, I shouldn't have spoken like that, I'm really awful, I'm a terrible person, I'm a failure as a monk, I did this terrible thing. So when we go forth, the encouragement I often like to give is to recognize that we need to learn how to fail in a good way, which means to say, yeah, that was pretty harsh what I said to the novice, and yeah, we do need to move the woodpile. True, but I didn't need to speak quite so bluntly, and I could make excuses for myself, but I won't. That was poorly done, and so I recognize that, and so this hurts. Ow! I think of having spoken that way, and what happens is that my heart is painful. Ow! But as we say in the Buddhist way of speaking, this is here, that pain is a good pain. It's hiryotapa. It's our moral sensitivity. So it's good that it hurts, because just like physical pain protects the body, hiryotapa, that psychological pain, protects our heart and protects our relations with others and the world around us. So just like physical pain helps us to protect our body and to keep safe, that same sort of psychological pain protects our heart and protects our life in the world, so that when we see a wrongdoing on our part, we see we've done something that was selfish or greedy or aggressive or whatever, that to recognize that painful feeling and say, yeah, that was poorly done, and then to listen to the Buddha's encouragement, which was to say, to recognize our transgression as such and to endeavor to do better in the future. This is called development. This is called furtherance in the Buddha Sasana. That's how we develop. We don't develop by never making mistakes. In a way, the Buddha describes it, we develop by failing and learning from our failures. So I'm not encouraging you to deliberately fail or to get things wrong or to be aggressive to the novices, but to recognize when we miss our shot, when we do make mistakes, to make sure that the first thought in the mind is what can I learn from this? What is this teaching me? Rather than, on the one hand, oh, I'm an awful person, I'm terrible, I should be punished, I'm corrupting the Sangha here, I should leave because I'm spoiling the vibes at Abhayagiri. I'm such an awful person. Or at the other end of the spectrum, saying, well, I'm fine. If they got a problem with the way I am, that's tough. they should just get over it. Yeah, self-justifying. But rather taking the middle way of recognizing, yes, that was poorly done. That was a mistake. I didn't get that right. I was forgetful. Okay, duly noted. Let's learn from that and try to do better in the future. So then taking on the extra precepts doesn't become a cause of anxiety and worry that you're going to get everything, you've got more things to get wrong, but rather it's a way of helping us to live more acutely and sensitively, more harmoniously with the world around us, with the fellow Sangha members, and with the people that we share our lives with. The last thing I'd like to say, I always like to make a recognition, is that we wouldn't be sitting here in this particular spot if it wasn't for the generosity of Master Xuan Hua, that 20 years ago, at the to little bit of Sangha history again, we before the rain starts, I've been coming here to the California every year since 1990 for a few months. There was the plan to open up a monastery. It was held up a little bit because of difficulties in the Sangha and things not being very very stable. But on May the 31st, 1995, there was a Sangha meeting in Britain, and they said, okay, things are stabilized enough. We're happy for you to start looking for land in the U.S. Please, you have the permission of the community to go ahead. So, oh, sātu, thank you very much. So I left that Sangha meeting at about 6 o'clock in the evening on May 31st. Walking down the corridor, June the 1st, in the monks' vihara at Amravati, Ajahn Viradhamma was sitting in his room. His door was open. Said, oh, Tan Amro, just got a phone call from Lumpur Sumedho. He's in Long Beach, where he went to see Master Hua. Master Hua has just given us 120 acres of land in California. What do you think about that? My first thought was, that was quick. So less than 24 hours. And not only that, but Master Hua, who had reputation for having all kinds of colorful psychic abilities, he was actually on his deathbed at the time. So, sātu, sātu, sātu. And then exactly a year later, May 31st, Ajahn Kurundamo took the 8 precepts, and then June the 1st, we rolled wagons to come up here. So without the great graciousness and generosity of Master Xuan Hua, who gave us this half of the land at Abayagiri, we would not be here. So I feel it's a wonderful legacy, also a gesture of Sangha harmony, that he made that offer with no strings attached, and that the blessings that have come from that since that time in the last 20 years have been manifold, countless, incalculable. So I express my gratitude to him and his community for their great generosity. So I will leave it there for my reflections for today, and I wish the newly hatched bhikkhus, samaniras, all the very best. Nibbana pachayo hotu. May your going forth be the basis for Nibbana.
Annamayang avargataya sadhu karang dadamase.
Sadhu, 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 anumodayam.